discussed last week the first section of our passage in verses 25 through 32. We are doing this as a part of a greater study here in the fourth chapter, dealing with the necessity of being converted, and that the concept of conversion indicates transformation. That was the primary doctrinal consideration that we have in mind, that conversion requires a transformed life. And what we find in verses 25 and going down through the end of the chapter is a set of scriptures which establish what a transformed life is like: walking in love, walking in righteousness, walking in godliness. And this is done in two ways: by telling us what we are to refrain from doing, how we're to stop acting, and then how we are to act instead. And so you'll see this kind of a contrast where the two are put opposite one another a number of times through this particular section that we're studying. So it has some very real and good practical application for us. It's very profitable for us to seek to make application of the principles that are found here. So if you'll notice, beginning in verse 25, read very down through verse 32 quickly. It says, "Putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we're members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you." So you see again some of the negative things that were to put off, what they are to be replaced with, specifically in verse 32, kindness, tenderheartedness, a spirit of forgiveness. These are things that should be characteristic of the Christian. So again, once an individual is converted, he becomes a child of God. Things that were characteristic of his life, his demeanor, his attitude, his character, these are things that should be set aside, those that are opposite of the Christian profession, our walk, and instead they are to be replaced with the various fruit of the Spirit and other attributes that are to be characteristic of God's people. There are some reasons for it. There are some illustrations that are given in this text, but there is also the list that we want to acknowledge both here and in the fifth chapter. So what we talked about in our discussion last week, the first two that are in this list, we talked about the responsibility that we have to put away lying and speak the truth one with another. And then we spent a great deal of time actually talking about anger. And you'll remember we emphasized that anger is not intrinsically sinful, but it certainly can be. And it also is something that is an emotion that makes a Christian vulnerable, because anger can lead to sinful expression. And so we are given that responsibility to be angry and sin not, as we are instructed here in the particular text. So as a part of that, of course, that do not give place to the devil, as it has that practical application with regard to anger, that in your anger do not give him an opportunity to lead you to sin. That gets us down to the third in this list that is given, and that is that we are not to steal. So if you'll notice verse 28 of the text, "Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need." So in this particular statement, there are a couple of things I think that are interesting. First of all, there is an acknowledgement on the part of the apostle that not everyone who was living as a Gentile was actually engaging in this particular sin of theft. And I think that's something that we might note with regard to each of the sins. We mentioned this, we might have mentioned it last week, how there is a tendency for us, as we look at individuals who are in the world, we see people sometimes who are very moral individuals. And we think to ourselves, perhaps, that, well, that particular individual, if he would simply be receptive to the gospel, he wouldn't have to change his life all that much. And I think it's a mistake to think that way, because a transformation is indeed needed. We are no longer living for selves. We are now living for Christ. We are slaves to Christ. And characteristically, what individuals do as they live in the world without respect to God or service to God is that they do not strive to do Christ's will. They do what it is that they desire to do. And just to give an example, this particular example, as a means of illustrating this, there are an awful lot of people who are worldly people. They may get drunk on occasion, but they're not going to drink and drive. But why is that? Well, because primarily it's against the law, and there are repercussions to that. So while they may be guilty of imbibing, and as a result of that becoming inebriated, they would never consider getting a car. And it's not so much that, or driving a car, it's not so much that in doing that they're worried about displeasing God, it's that they're worried about the consequences of that. And the same thing can be said with regard to stealing. Someone who might have a temptation or a desire to obtain something that is not his, does not belong to him, he may refrain from doing that, because if he did it, he might get caught, and if he got caught, there may be consequences. And sometimes the consequences in other cultures and other times can be very dire. With us, it might be a slap on the hand. Someone, some other culture, some other time, it may be cutting the hand off. Which was a particular punishment that has been, and even today in some cultures still continues to be done for one who steals. But there are others who are not sufficiently constrained by possible consequences or fear that will indeed engage in that particular sin. And so he says, as a Christian now, if you did have as a practice taking something that was not lawfully or rightfully yours in the past, well, don't do it anymore. And there is, secondly, in this particular context, there is this idea that there is a principle of industry and work in this that contrasts with seeking ill-gotten gains. So in other words, things that you don't have a right to, things that are done without your effort, things that are not, that if they are obtained, they are obtained illicitly. As contrasted within the latter part of this, laboring, working with your hands, what is good, indicates honest labor, talking about labor that is in itself intrinsically either righteous and good, or without fault, without unrighteousness as a part of it. And there is a reason for this. And this is the imperative of love, as we indicated with lying. The same imperative of love precludes you taking from another what is not earned. So, for example, if I, as an employee, do one of two things. If I am paid by my employer, but I do not give him the labor that we have contracted together for me to give him. In other words, I'm lazy and indolent. I'm not fulfilling my job requirements, but I'm taking money from that employer. Well, that's something that would be considered sinful. Secondly, if I were to take things, rob him of possessions or something as a part of that work. But the second thing is this idea that what my purpose in laboring in this way, in an honest way, is so that I may benefit others. And so you've got two things that are contrasted one with another. The idea of selfishness, to where I'm going to take even things that do not belong to me, I'm going to take because I want. I'm not concerned with how it impacts someone else. I'm only concerned with gratifying myself. And then you have the imperative of love, where I'm not seeking my own welfare, I am seeking the welfare of others, and my motivation as I do engage in these activities is in part so that I can benefit someone else by the fruit of my labor. So if I work in such an honest way, then my employer benefits, because we've contracted together, I work and I am industrious and I accomplish something for him, And by the way, you think about the way employment works in this situation, an employer, one who's seeking to make money from a business, of necessity, in order for him to make money, he needs to receive in return value above what you offer to him. It's called profit. And so I work hard, and as a result of my working hard, I bring him money. He has money to pay me with, but he has money left over as profit, or else there's no reason for him to be in business. But we have contracted together that my labor is worth this much, so I'm going to labor sufficiently to receive this wage. And when I receive these wages, because I am a Christian, and because I am not selfish, but rather selfless, I am going to utilize the funds that I have when opportunity arises to help my neighbor, to help my brother in Christ, to benefit others. And so there is a real contrast between the selfishness of stealing and the selflessness of laboring so that you can have something to give another who has a need. And I think that, again, the imperative of love is something that is characteristic of every aspect of the Christian's life. The idea of being outside of self and directing your thoughts and intents toward others, seeking their highest good, their welfare rather than your own, looking out for their interests and not only your own interests, as Philippians 2 tells us, that is something that impacts every aspect of our life. And I don't know how many of us really take the time to consider that, you know, when we go to work and do our 9 to 5, a 40-hour week, or some of you 50 and 60 and 70-hour weeks, but you spend that time in working, and you work to make a living, and I understand that, but understand that a part of this, the whole construct as a Christian, as a part of the labor of your hands, is so that you will have something to share with an individual who is at want, who has need. And that's the love that we're to show as Christians. So you're going to see this again and again. The contrast, primarily, when it says the evil things as compared with the good things, is whether you're acting selfishly or selflessly. And we'll see that parallel going down through all of these examples. So, anybody want to add anything to the concept of stealing no longer? All right, the next thing then in our list that is given has to do with corrupt language. Notice verse 29, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that may impart grace to the hearers. Idle words bring the judgment of God upon us. We need to be careful about this, and there's actually more that is listed as we get into the fifth chapter about this concept of language. Now, what we want to emphasize here is the danger that is inherent in corrupt language or corrupt words. It's a very broad phrase that is used here. We are told in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, interesting how often Peter's first epistle parallels Paul's. But he states there in verse 9 that we're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. There is a description of the type of language and the purpose of our communication. It is speech that should impart grace. And that's what needs to be in our mind. And so as a result of that, when we talk about corrupt words, those are things that, in speaking them, do not bring edification. What does the word edification mean? It means to build up. But rather, they are words, language, that in some way is destructive to others. It can have reference to being destructive to relationship. We talk about slander and gossip as examples of that, where they're very destructive words. That would be an example of corrupt language. A person who is engaging in gossip, as a result of that, can ruin friendships. Not only the friendships that he entertained with others as a result of his gossip, because resentment will come. You gossip about someone else, and they find out that you're the one that's gossiping about them, and that friendship is over. But also, because individuals may listen to the gossip and believe that gossip, they may be influenced with regard to their relationship, and you can ruin others as well. So that's an example of corrupt language. That would be, rather than edifying or building up, it would be something that would be destructive. We also could talk about profanity, innuendo, scatological or profane humor. Those are things that are corrupting of morality. Coarse language, we'll look a little bit later on in our discussion of coarse jesting, vulgarities. These are kinds of things that, again, do not build individuals up, but they can be corrupting with regard to the morality of individuals. And this is another kind of example. So lying, of course, would be a specific in this generic concept of corrupted communication. It could be just about anything. But again, keep in mind this concept, imperative of love. If I speak to impart grace, if I speak to build up, if I speak to edify, that's something that is indicating the welfare of others. But if what I say is, well, I don't care what anyone else thinks because I'm going to say what I want to say, I'm going to do what I want to do, that kind of selfishness is often destructive. And it certainly can be the case with regard to the language that we use. So profanity is one that is kind of a special concern of mine. It's bothersome to me to see individuals who are speaking profanely. It's so pervasive in our culture today. It's so ugly. And the interesting thing about it is it's just... It just doesn't mean much to people anymore. It's such a common thing that when you complain about it, they look at you like you're rather a peculiar person. What's the big deal? Just being real. It's just the way everybody speaks. It's just part of our culture. But it's evil. It's ugly. And it's certainly something that should not be characteristic of God's people. Whenever I see women using profanity, it's just something that curdles the stomach. But again, it's something that's characteristic of our culture. If you have ever had an interest, talk to Josh about the language of his students at school. And I think I mentioned this several months ago, but this last, and correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, but this last year, you know, it's always been against the rules in school to cuss. And so you get in trouble if the teacher overheard you. But they were getting so many referrals down to the office that this year they were given instruction, teachers were, is to ignore the profanity unless they're cussing you out. If they're cussing you out, they refer them. But if it's just a matter of their language in the class, it's just so pervasive, it's so common, they're using it, it's second nature to them, that it's a losing battle in effect. And just don't worry about it. And can you imagine we've got to that point in our culture where that's the case? But it pretty much is, at least in certain circumstances, situations. So that's something that is especially bothersome to me. And I think maybe one of the reasons is because, you know, you guys, you go out into the world in your interaction with people in the offices and businesses that you're a part of. And an unfortunate thing is, as a result of that, you hear it. And if I keep my TV on channels to where that's not prevalent, and my interaction, not exclusively, but primarily, is with you people. So you know, when I'm working in my office or at home, and I'm by myself, and I'm studying and immersing myself in those things. And so when I get out in public and I hear it, it really bothers me. As a result of that. But that's where our culture is. So we as Christians, as always, are called not to be like the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our minds, as Romans 12 tells us. And corrupt language is something characteristic of the Gentiles, and the Christians are not to involve themselves in. Yes, Justin?
What desensitized you to men cussing?
It's not desensitized. I'm not desensitized to it because that appalls me as well. But
but you wouldn't bring women out if women doing it didn't bother you.
It bothers me more. Yes, and can I say I'm not desensitized to the other, but I'm more sensitive to the former? I mean, I understand. It's a double standard, and yet it's not, in the sense that men and women are different, and there are these expectations that have been present in the culture, or were present in the culture in the past, with regard to being demure, modest, and chaste with regard to women. There is the difference in the typical personality of women versus men, the nurturing, those kinds of things. And I'm sure some of it's cultural as well. So there, you know, and I'm not saying, but anyway, in saying that, I'm not in any way justifying it or saying that it's more acceptable for men. I'm just saying that gut visceral reaction that I receive.
I think it probably is the culture. I think it's that it got more accepted in movies with men doing it before women. And I think it's that you heard stories about whatever, your dad on the oil field or whatever else in the world.
Maybe so.
Where you heard about men doing it, but you didn't hear about women.
Yeah. No distinction, no difference as to the unacceptability of it in conversation. It's no more acceptable for men to do it than it is to women. It's just that, again, when I see a woman cuss, it just turns my stomach even more, I guess. So, yeah, cultural is probably a big part of the history.
Justin's too young to remember when men that cursed would not curse in front of a woman. They respected women as I don't care who they were, they were two ladies. And I've seen men get in fights because they cursed in front of a woman, disrespected a woman by cursing.
Yeah.
And another guy that sat over there and cursed would fight a guy that did it in front of a woman, but it's okay in front of a man.
Right. Yeah.
So I think it's just a difference in culture.
Yeah.
And people don't have respect for women anymore. And one reason is because women don't act like they used to. As general.
Yeah. Well, when you look at, and we discussed this in First Peter, in that discussion of how women are to conduct themselves with regard to their husbands and the call for modesty and chastity and humility and those things, there's a dearth of that in our culture, certainly. And the chivalry that should be present among men is
Women wanted equal rights. So when they started, you know, that started coming on, men said, okay, if you want to trust them, we don't want to respect you anymore like we used to.
Yeah, yeah, that's the culture is a big part of it as far as the change. And I'm old enough to where that change is something that bothers me. Yeah. Culture. Yes, Dennis?
That's pretty much what I was going to say. The reason you did that is because you have personal memory and experience when you were young. When you did not hear women do this, or young girls do this, you've always heard in your lifetime men do it, and as well as I, Jerry, all of us do now. But it's only in your later life that you begin to hear women do it, and that started affecting men.
Elaine?
I think corrupt speech has more than just profanity. I find profanity completely offensive, and I complain at work if they use it, men or women. But when you are raising children in this day and age, and the people that they're supposed to respect are bullies, they call out names, and it's all over the press, then it's hard for you to turn around and say, you're not to act like this. And so we do that as Christians. Say, we're different. You're not to act like this. You're not to talk like this. This is wrong. But when you're dealing with children of the world and worldly parents, it seeps into their household, and their parents are not as likely to say, you can't talk about so-and-so this way. Whether it's the child sitting next to them in the classroom, or, you know, any pop references or anything like that.
Yeah, you're right. And that culture, again, is the culture that exists in the first century as well. I mean, this contrast is always going to be there. It's cyclical, so it gets worse at certain times. But you do make a point, and of course, I think I emphasized this earlier, that corrupt communication is a very inclusive term that is indicative of anything that destroys or corrupts rather than building up. But the example that you gave there, bullying, of name-calling, of being dismissive or being seeking to humiliate, being critical, those kinds of things. I'm not talking about constructive criticism or admonition. I'm talking about you're not worth anything and you're an idiot and those kinds of things that you hear characteristically in the world. Again, those perhaps may be a more dangerous thing for Christians, because it's not profanity. We're not, you know, telling dirty jokes. But we're on Facebook and someone says something, and so we call them an idiot. You know, that it's something that's equally sinful and another example of corrupt speech. So, and that's an unfortunate thing. It's been the case. A civil discourse in politics, for example, is gone. People act in, you know, the last set of debates in the presidential election, I couldn't watch them. I mean, I had to turn them off because it's like a bunch of third graders getting together and you idiot head. I mean, it's kind of weird, dumb, stupid things that are being said back and forth. It's ridiculous. It's absurd that it has reached that point that you cannot have civil discourse in our world. But that's kind of where it is. But Christians don't need to participate. Certainly don't need to act that way. It's inappropriate for us that way. Yes, Josh?
Well, along with what she was saying, you know, the parents at home, the children of the world, not really emphasizing these things. And going to school as well, you know, when I tell people, you know, that we're not supposed to rock pearls anymore for that, but they still... If I hear that in my class, hey, you be quiet, don't do that language in here, or watch your mouth, watch your language, that sort of thing. They just kind of roll their eyes. But in that situation, we kind of like what she was saying, we really don't have a leg to stand on because, you know, whether it goes to the language or dress, why can't I dress this way? You know, well, that's the rules, but, you know, why is that the rule? Because everything that they see, people speak like that, people dress like that. TV, it's on the internet, it's music especially that they listen to. And I think the music is the biggest influencer with our generation as far as language goes. With this generation, they are all, some of them, they're listening to music. You know, if they're awake 18 hours a day, they're listening to music 16 of those 18 hours. And that's just how they are with technology being connected and everything. But to tie into what we're talking about here, you know, it's not the place of a Christian. We've got to be careful of that stuff influencing us, especially with parents and children. We can't count on institutions such as education and schooling to influence that morality on our children. Used to, you could...
There was structure there.
There was structure, and there was more of that expectation. And obviously, you never expected the school to teach your children how to be morally. But you could, you know, you could count on them to at least require a certain standard. And you can't do that anymore. And that's something I think is new with how far our culture has degraded. And there's so many ways for... access to that immorality, it's a challenge, and it's something I think we've got to think about, that, you know, generations of parents in the past might not have had to certain institutions.
Yeah, you people that are raising kids right now, I feel for you. Yeah, I remember when I was young, Jim Croce had that song, Leroy Brown. There was a cuss word in that, very mild one that you hear all the time nowadays, comparatively. And it was scandalous. I remember singing along with it and not stopping singing whenever that word came on. But now with rap music, the vulgarity of rap music is, and Josh was talking about the musical influence, because I don't know about how, I mean, there's a generational divide here with regard, but understand that people younger than me, I put myself in the old group now, so people younger than me pretty much grew up with headphones in their ears. I mean, that's, in other words, and I listen to sports and podcasts whenever I'm working out, but everybody at the gym where I work out, they all have headphones in, and they're all just about listening to music, almost every one of them. Well, rap music, it's music. I don't see the appeal of it, but it's music. But it's just the vulgarity is pervasive in that music. And so yeah, they're hearing it all the time. And it's not surprising that it's affected the way they speak. So again, it's a challenge. But again, our purpose is not to bend the world to our standards. What we're trying to do is to get people out of the world and into the kingdom of God, where they will modify their behavior. And so you have those who are without, they are the Gentiles. They will think it strange that we do not act the way they do. They will speak evil of us as a result of it. But we're a holy nation, and as we convert individuals into Christ, we have to emphasize that, okay, how you once acted, you no longer can act that way. Now you've got to act differently, and these are the things that you must do. These are the things you must refrain from doing. And we've got to modify our thinking. That's what conversion is. It is a transformation. And that's what needs to be emphasized. I saw a hand up here. Yes, Dave.
Yeah. I can remember when profanity and immorality was not allowed on radio and TV, and it was censored. It wasn't censored by the government. It was censored both in the TV and the movies, also included that. It was by the Hayes office, and whoever funded it lost their funding of all that I think 1954, and of course it gradually got worse like it. You know, like James said about, you know, conceived in the and sin just continues to grow. And so of course it was censorship by of course they had to get approved by the Hayes office, and then with the radio TV they had to, you know, and they go out and they get by the heads of the broadcast and TV and how that worked back then.
That's all the hell that's there. I read an article about that recently, and the article indicated that the reason why they governed themselves in that regard is because if they hadn't, the government was going to step in and say, we don't want that to happen, so we'll do it ourselves, and they self-governed.
No, when I was in high school, nobody knew profanity. That's way back when.
Well, by the time I got in high school, Dick, they were. There were, but I didn't hear it from the women very often. I did hear it from the young men. Yes, Brad?
You've ever sat on the bathroom sink with Laura Iver soap in your mouth? I guess my saying to the young parents, don't be afraid of that bar of soap, because it will leave a lasting impression.
Okay, that's an elder's advice right there. So you can say he did well. You're next after yes. Good. Oh sure. Yeah, when we're talking about popular culture, whether it be the music, and again, rap is especially egregious, but it is a function of the degradation of culture and how far it's gone. But yeah. That's true. Yeah, the corrupting influence of popular culture has been felt for a long time. I mean, again, what's the first profanity ever issued in movies? On Gone with the Wind, you know, and there is a video. There's a company called VidAngel that you can subscribe to it as you're doing streaming TV shows and movies. It actually will bleep out all of that. I mean, it doesn't bleep it; it just silences it. And they had in order to advertise their service, they had a video where they had a paint gun and they had a family sitting on the couch and they had like 150 paint guns. And so they referenced Gone with the Wind and shot the paint gun, hit the boy, I think it was, in the chest and kind of surprised him. And then, and so he gets hit, so that's the first time it happened. And then I think the next section of it was The Wolf of Wall Street, I think, or some other show that had the most profanity ever used in a single film. It's like 3,500. Cuss words in a single hour and a half or 2 hour movie, and so they unleashed on this family with those paint guns, one shot for every single cuss word issued, and it just, you know, just obliterated them, yeah, and everything behind them, and so it's just a pretty interesting way of getting the point across, is that it's pervasive and you're getting inundated with it and your kids are getting inundated with it, and so please use our service so that you don't. So anybody want to use VidAngel, it's a good service to use. I mean, you know, some of those shows you still shouldn't be watching, but regardless, it's better than nothing in that regard. So again, that's just a good way to illustrate that. So popular culture, as it's gone on, it didn't start off that bad, but there was bad there, and as it's gone on, it's gotten worse and worse and worse. Who was? Yes, Jay.
Do you think that Just going back to what Brad said, well, when you hear that word, you taste soap.
So you got the treatment too, did you? Or did you get it, or did you dole it out?
I was a teacher. I remember very well. I had my mouth washed out with soap. For a long time, if I never hear that word, I taste soap.
So maybe there's some effectiveness in parenting techniques, guys. Keep that in mind. All right. Yes?
It was used.
Okay.
It was used.
You got it too, huh?
I got it too.
I never got it. There are other techniques you use, but
you know, I was thinking about the angel the other day. That's probably one of the best examples I've seen of how much culture has changed. There you have a company where they will skip sections of violence or nudity or whatever in the world, and they will mute audio wherever you want it done. But in their advertising, they use a euphemism. And so something that I definitely would have gotten in trouble for as a kid, they use in selling their service to not speak.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, we get a lot of comments and a lot of references to soap in the back. Let's go on and try to get through this material before we run out of time, because I've got one other mention at the bottom part of this, verse 31 of the list. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking put away from you with all malice. I want you to look at that last word there, malice. What that is indicating is something, again, that it's an expression of evil intent. A malicious person is a person who acts in an evil way, an injurious way, a harmful way. A person who has malice in their heart, they desire to injure others. And I think that's an interesting... I like her squeal. That's good. There's an interesting, I think, correlation with that word malice with these examples given in verse 31. Bitterness and wrath and anger. Now, we've already talked about being angry, but do not sin. But this anger in this particular list is combined with these other kinds of actions, clamor and evil speaking. So a person who is desiring to harm another, and it may be that they harm them through speech. It may be that their wrathfulness and the malice in their heart leads them to other expressions of evil. It emanates from bitterness, a bitter heart. And again, the same kind of idea that we've talked about already is that these things come from a selfish demeanor instead of a selfless one. Because the selfless individual is the one who bears up under the harm that is done to him, the injury that is given to him. The selfish person acts like, how dare you treat me this way? I'm going to get you back. And I think that's the sentiment that's being expressed in verse 31 in these ideas of bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking. We're told in James chapter 1 in verse 20 that the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And so that kind of a demeanor, that again is something very, very prevalent. And a lot of people will justify it. And they'll say, I'm just counterpunching. You know, I'll leave another person alone, but if they come at me, I'm going to come back at them twice as hard. Well, that's the kind of attitude that we're talking about here. And that's not supposed to be the attitude of a Christian. So we've got a big list here, and all of these examples that we have are examples of lives that are characteristically lived in the Gentile way. And he said, you've done that enough. Stop doing that. Don't act that way anymore. And he says, instead, in verse 32 of the text, put away those evil things and be kind to one another. What a novel thought. Be kind to one another. Tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God forgave you. Now, you'll notice, we'll just kind of make a note of this because it'll lead to our next week's study. In chapter 5 and verse 1, he says, be imitators of God as dear children. Walk in love as Christ has loved us and gave himself for us, an offering and sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. So it's all tied together. The idea is that was the characteristic life you live. Now the life you live is one that is like God. It is one that is like Christ. We're to be an imitator of God. Well, what was God like? God loved the world enough to send His Son to die for us. Jesus loved the world enough to offer Himself up as a sacrifice. God loved us in that because we are sinners, when we come to Him in repentance, He's willing to forgive us. And as He is that way, that kind of being, then characteristically we are to be the same way. God was kind. He expressed that kindness in His redemptive work. God is tenderhearted when He saw how people were rebelling against Him. It did not turn Him completely away from mankind. It doesn't mean He tolerates it. But He also gives us opportunity for redemption, opportunity for reconciliation. That's tenderhearted. And He's willing to forgive. And that should be characteristic of Christians. So if we were to look at that, they don't actually correlate in the sense of, okay, get rid of this and replace it with that. In that sense, here's a list of sins, and then there are these three terms: to be kind, tender-hearted, and forgiving. But what that indicates again is, instead of acting the way you want to act, instead of not considering or being interested in what others or how others have to deal with you or the consequences of what you've done, as it is injurious to people, instead keep in mind that selflessness that was characteristic of God. And that imperative of love that governed His actions, and make that the be-all and end-all of your existence as a Christian. And that contrast is a very, very strong one. Now, keep that in mind and recognize why, then, it is so hypocritical, so invalid for an individual to say, I'm a Christian, when they're characteristically engaging in those kinds of activities. Not necessarily all of them, but some of them, where their language is impure or corrupted, where their attitudes are selfish, where their treatment of others, where revenge is on their heart and malice is in their heart. And yet, I'm a Christian. No, you can't be a Christian and be that way, because Christians are imitators of God, and God's not that way. And so when people dismiss it, it's not that big a deal. And they say, as the theology claims, that once saved, always saved, so I can live the way I want and I'm still going to heaven. It just doesn't jive with what the Scripture teaches about the kind of people we're supposed to be.
I hate to leave this class. It's very good on this subject here. But I hate to leave it on the note of parents being inundated with this all around them, so just give in to it.
Oh, no.
I know you're not saying,
no,
that,
not saying that,
but the point is, there's things we still can do. You know, you turn the TV off.
That's right.
You know, you can restrict the music. I'm a mean old grandma. When my grandchildren come in, you know, if they've got those things going, I question them. And they know pretty well that, you know, it's not going to be allowed. And so they really don't do it. I mean, that's not like they sneak around to do it. But I still check.
Yeah.
And I think that's the...
It's just an indicator of just how more challenging.
It is a challenge.
It is to be a parent.
I understand that.
Yeah. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention. We'll stop there and pick up with the next phrase. Let's see here. In chapter 4, verse 30. Do not grieve the Holy Spirit. We want to discuss that a little bit. Thank y'all for your kind attention.